This is Car Expert.
Subaru should know by now that the reaction to their concepts is always really positive. So why don't they just release concepts where it's just the production vehicle?
I just think it's an incredibly interesting trend that we're seeing with manufacturers carting up their EVs and making them look retro.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner, and a big hello to James Wong.
Hi, Mandy.
And William Stopford, hello.
A big hello to you. Oh, I just get a hello. He gets a big hello.
Ah.
Wow.
Yeah, favoritism.
And Matt, with a big hello for a big head of hair that I've got over here. Yeah.
Lockdown hair. Oh, isn't it great? Well, I see a model car. We can obviously see each other. We're using a platform called Zencaster, so we can see each other. What's the model car you've got sitting there on your desk?
So I have several model cars on my desk. I'm sure if I recall on one podcast, I was running late because I was off purchasing a model car. I've since vowed to not buy any more of them because I'm trying to save for things. I have something very strange. So I've actually got a couple of 118 scale Cadillacs. One's an XLR, which to me is one of the most breathtaking, you know, designs ever. I love it. I know a lot of people hate it, but it's just nothing but angles. There's no curve on it. So I can understand why they made a 118 scale version of that. A 2000 Cadillac DeVille DTS, I'm not so sure why. When I was a kid, I pretty much only played with like Matchbox and Hot Wheels cars, and I used to just love when the more mundane, boring cars, the better. I didn't have I didn't collect Ferraris or anything like that. Never really been my interest. So when I saw a 118 scale version of something that's really not that exciting, although I'm a bit of a Cadillac fan, so I was excited, I just had to get it. It's even in silver. It's even in just boring silver. People probably just come into this office and look at my desk and think, why does he have that? But actually really funny, because I was talking to you earlier, Mandy, before the show about how I, you know, people are going to judge me for this. I'm going to have my car enthusiast card revoked or something. But I came this close to going to check out a Seville STS earlier this year. The seller was actually messaging me actively, like he was really
no
keen to sell it. Because I don't understand, because they were made in right-hand drive and exported to the UK and Japan, but they weren't officially exported here. But a lot of them have come from Japan. And it's, you know, it's front-wheel drive. It's a giant front-wheel drive sedan with a V8. So that already doesn't make sense. But
wow.
I test drove one once. I was surprised how little torque there was considering that drive layout. And I was like this close to going and checking out this Seville STS. And I didn't, because I said, I already have one car that I don't drive. I don't need two. And now I'm kind of regretting it. Every time I look at this DeVille on my desk, I'm like, maybe I should have.
But the one that got away.
Yes, exactly. Well, the two, actually. He was selling two. Who has two Japanese import Cadillac Seville STSs? Gluttons for punishment.
I reckon. Wow. Speaking of model cars, I'm moving house soon into a one bedroom apartment, and my biggest hobby is collecting model cars. And when you're moving into a one bedroom apartment, you need to start culling things. And I have three boxes, like full plastic containers full of model cars, and like something's got to happen with these.
Yeah, you need to have some
shelves. I have to go through them. I didn't want to, though. It was heartbreaking going through them. So I basically had two boxes, one box keeping, one box that's going. And the one box that was going was full of Matchbox and Hot Wheels cars still in their packages. Pretty much every single one I had was in the going up box. And
wow.
I've kept the model cars that actually weren't that aren't worth a lot of money these days, and they're days gone cars made by Leto back in the mid to late 80s, and they're vintage cars. I think they're, I don't know, maybe 124 scale or something like that. I can't quite remember. They're cars from like the 1920s to maybe the 1940s.
Wow.
Beautifully detailed and designed. It's the reason why I love them, but they're worth bugger all these days, but I've kept them because they look absolutely gorgeous to display. It's like, you know, those old panel vans with the old sign writing on the side.
Oh, yeah.
That sort of stuff. Just fantastic. So I've kept them, but got rid of the Matchbox and Hot Wheels because they're a dime a dozen.
Mm.
And unsurprisingly, they're all pretty much Volkswagen.
Of course.
But it still pained me because I'm like, that's easily probably 15, 20 years of buying supermarket model cars of Matchbox and Hot Wheels that are going to another home now. So
that's what I had to do. I had to just stop walking down that aisle at the supermarket because I'd always see something. And then if you ever went to a toy store, I can't remember what it was, like Greenlight Collectibles and a few companies like that would make like Ford Pintos and Ford Mustang 2s and just exactly the kind of like, really, they made a model of that stuff that just really tickles me. And now I've got like a tub too, maybe not as big as yours, but I've got a tub of stuff too that I don't have on display because they're kind of, you know, they're kind of too small to, unless you have like a nice display cabinet, but you don't want to, you know, Mandy, if you have a lot of stuff, you just need to find a family member that has a large storage space under their house and just leave it there. Like,
I've been doing that for years.
It's so it's come bad. To an end now. You can't throw this stuff out because you feel bad doing that because, you know, it's actually like decent stuff. But also you don't want to sell it because, effort. I have so much like old magazines and stuff I no longer need. And I don't want to go to all the effort of selling it. So...
Yep, I know, feel your pain. You know what, one thing I did find in my collection, do you guys remember Micro Machines?
Yes, I think.
Did you have them? Like Micro Machines were like literally the size of your fingernail. They were tiny.
Yes, I think I remember them vaguely. They were quite a thing when I was a kid.
Yeah, they
Sounds
were.
Sounds like a choking hazard.
Oh, very much so.
That's why they no longer make Micro Machines.
They're actually a little bit collectible. It's just made completely of plastic. You can pick up some really rare models, but they've remade them now. So you can get it, like recreations of them, except they're bigger and they're just not the same.
Oh, they're Macro Machines now.
Yes.
But look, you have moved into you're buying your own place, and that means you can do whatever you want. You can paint the walls. You can put gorgeous shelves in and display these things because no one's going to criticize you for...
I know. That's exactly what I'm doing. When I started obsessing over model cars or cars, my dad made me a massive shadow box. So it would probably be, maybe 1.5 meters long. And he built like 3 or 4 different shelves in it just to display my model cars. He made it out of wood. And I still have it, and I haven't used it since I've moved about a gazillion times in the last couple of years. But now, Will, as you say, I have my own place. I can nail in as many nails as I want in those damn walls, and
time
I can hang those
shadow
model cars
on.
Yes. Yeah, so... model cars of yours, J-Wo, do you have any on display or are they all in boxes as well?
Well, you remember one of our previous jobs, Mandy, where both of our desks were full of model cars?
True, yes.
I still have them in the boxes from when I left said last job. Yeah, I haven't found another place for most of them because I brought them to the office in the first place because I didn't have anywhere to put them at home. So then I was like, I have a place to put them now. And I'm too scared to put them on my new desk because I'm concerned about the cleanup afterwards. And I like the fact that I've got a very minimalist desk right now that doesn't stress me out. So, but I have heaps of stuff. When I was very young, my family members or my parents, they always used to buy me the Barago models. So I have heaps of those. I have a lot of Hot Wheels and Matchbox, but like I preferred the older ones because I never have been someone to like, you know, how the Hot Wheels and some of the video games, how they don't have licensed cars. They just do like the generic whatever. I was never into stuff like that. I wanted the stuff that you could buy in a showroom.
Yeah,
me too. Yeah, I wasn't into the concept sort of looking cars.
Boring. Yeah,
weird.
I've got a little kid's briefcase that was an actual toy car holder, and I think it actually is here under my bed.
Let's see it.
Well, is it here or have I moved it?
While he's looking, cars with actual painted headlights and taillights and opening doors.
Yes.
Oh wow! Look at you.
Yeah, so it's got it. I've got it here. You can hear all the rumbling around. It's double-sided.
And it's see-through.
So, yeah, so I've got some really cool ones. So some of the really classic Matchboxes, like I've got this little V8 Ford Falcon V8 supercar that's I've obviously played with a lot.
Mid-90s, hello.
Yes, it's got rubber wheels. So that's how old it is. Yes. Yes. And I've got, what else have I got? I've got an old Lamborghini Countach. You can tell that some of them are from when I was very young because the paint's been chipped off them and everything.
Good what's this?
I've got an old, speaking of weird ones, I've got an old green Mercedes E-Class.
Oh, wow.
You see, it's racing green.
Tinted tail lights.
I think this was from a Red Rooster mill.
What? Red Rooster was giving away free Matchbox cars?
Yeah, there was one period where they had like a Hot Wheels deal, and they did whatever their version of a kids meal was, because no one buys Red Rooster unless you're getting a roast chicken anymore. But they used to have a kids meal, and there was like several cars. Actually, here's one that Will might like. It's one of that really pointy Camaro. That from the 90s.
Oh. Camaro. Yes.
Oh, okay, sorry. Yes. The one, Camaro, the one time Will's accent says something correctly.
Oh. Every time I hear you people say Tesla, Chrysler, Camaro.
Yeah. I've even got like the old 90s Le Mans cars. So I've got like an old Porsche 911 GT1 as a thing, and it's got like the old racing livery on it. Yeah, I've got some really cool stuff in here. I've even got a Bugatti Veyron, an old 90s Toyota MR2 rally car. It's got like fog light plastic on it. Yeah, so I've got some really cool stuff in here that I'm a bit of a hoarder, so I don't let go of stuff. These things I was like, nah, that's my whole life in a box. And I used to collect those. I have a whole set of wooden Thomas the Tank engines as well, because Mum used to buy me those. I've still got all of the tracks and everything, because Mum's like, one day I'm going to have grandkids and they're going to go to them. And I was like, okay, cool. That's my show and tell.
I've kept all my childhood cars, Matchbox and Hot Wheels that you opened up to the box to play with them. They're all in a shoebox, and I'm never getting rid of them.
No. It's your childhood. It's like getting rid of your first teddy bear. Not going to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
And one day when everything's electric, you're going to look back and be like, see, this is how they used to make them.
Used to have rubber wheels, you see, and painted the headlights and the tail. Look at the doors open. So you don't get nowadays.
That voice really suits you, Will. It suits your aesthetic.
It's my Croft impression.
On that note, we probably should end this conversation right now. Right. Okay, so car news time. J-Wo, the 2022 Kia Carnival is coming, but missing a few features.
Yeah, so the new generation Carnival launched sort of at the very end of last year, the very beginning of this year. It was sort of weird because we're in between lockdowns and delays and all this kind of stuff, and launched when we were on holidays. Anyway, long story short was the top of the range model didn't get all the cool stuff that you see in overseas markets. So they offer like a digital instrument cluster, that cool blind spot view monitor system that projects a camera into your, like one of your digital dials. And it also doesn't have automatic wipers anywhere, which is weird. Yeah, I know. So part of it is like supply and semiconductors and all that other stuff. But Kia originally promised that we'd be getting these features to their whatever relevant model is meant to get them around August. But obviously we've run into more issues, and now the 2022 model, which was meant to launch with the new logo on the same body as the latest generation, and then with all these extra features, now it's just going to be a logo. So they're arriving in September. Unfortunately, we're still going to miss all this stuff that Korea and the US get, but they still have promised that we'll be getting it at a later date. What date that actually is, we don't know. So from what I personally had the conversation with Kia Australia at the day that this podcast is being recorded, and the spokesperson basically said it'll be a running change that'll be implemented at some point. We just don't know when. So whether it comes at in November, December, or January, February, and it's like MY22.5, so it's just extra features on the same car, we don't know. But it's just disappointing because a fully decked out Carnival diesel, 70 grand drive away, and you get less features than you do in a Sorento, which is essentially the same car but in an SUV body. It's just an interesting thing, but it goes to show just how affected some of these manufacturers are by component supply shortages and all that other stuff.
And part of it as well, because I recall attending the digital launch of the Kia Carnival, or attending something to do with it, there was supposed to be a unique steering or suspension tune for Kia products in Australia, but they said that COVID had actually affected that. So my understanding was we didn't end up getting a local steering tune because they just kind of ran out of time with lockdowns and things like that to actually get engineers here. It was too much of a logistical hurdle, so we've just gone with the Korean market steering tune. Which, they say is more than fine. I've driven a Carnival. I was just in one quite recently. You can view the review on carexpert.com.au. the steering is fine. So, look, I'm a little bit disappointed. I'm more disappointed that there's no rain-sensing wipers, because that's just a feature that, you know, you find in cars under 30,000 nowadays. Yeah. So to spend all that money on a platinum diesel and not get it. But at least it is coming, just unfortunately later than we expected.
And it's coming with a brand spanking new logo that's very important, Will.
Well, it is a nicer looking logo, I will say that.
It is, yes. the 2022 Volkswagen Amarok W580X has been revealed, Will. What a beast this thing looks.
Yes, it does look pretty beastly, doesn't it? So Volkswagen and Walkinshaw have teamed up again. So they previously brought the W580 and W580S here earlier this year. Now, those were more road-focused models, whereas the W580X is intended to be more of an kind of an off-road hero vehicle to go up against the likes of the Nissan Navara Warrior, the Toyota Hilux Rugged X, and, of course, the Ford Ranger Raptor. So it gets unique 18-inch alloy wheels. It gets your Walkinshaw branding everywhere you look. But it's not just a sticker pack here. It's not just a couple of decals slapped on. There's a suspension lift. It's got twin-tube MTV dampers, rock sliders, branded bash plates. There's more underbody protection, and you can also get a snorkel. So it is intended for the rough stuff. And of course, the feather in its cap is you know, the Volkswagen Amarok's feather, the 3-litre turbo diesel V6 with 190 kilowatts of power and 580 newton-meters of torque. So there's not any extra performance there compared to the W580 and W580S or indeed other Amarok V6s, but it's really quite amazing. After all these years, the Amarok is one of the oldest vehicles in the segment. Utes tend to have pretty long life cycles anyway, but it's one of the oldest vehicles in the segment, but it's still got that compelling point of difference because it has got that V6 turbo diesel when pretty much everything else has got a four banger. So there's still a reason to get it. Obviously, it doesn't have the safety technology that pretty much every other Ute in the segment has nowadays. It doesn't even have curtain airbags for the rear, which is a bit disappointing for something that's, you know, Utes are so commonly used as family haulers nowadays. But that V6 turbo diesel sure will tempt a lot of people. So if you want an Amarok that is a little bit more out there, because the regular Amarok's a bit kind of sedate looking, and if you want something that's perhaps going to be a little bit more capable off-road, there is now that option. So it is due here in April 2022. And I don't believe, no, pricing has not been revealed for this yet, but the W580 is $72,490 before on-roads, and the W580S is $79,990 before on-roads. I don't know where the ceiling is for the Ute segment. I mean, you see how much people are paying for Ranger Raptors, so come on. All these companies are just going to release more and more.
And the American Utes as well, like the Dodges and the like.
I mean, at that point, like you're spending that much for an Amarok or for a Ranger. A Ram doesn't seem like that much of a stretch.
True.
It's like, well, I'm already spending $80,000 on a Ute, so why not 100?
Joe, another brand has joined the EV-only group, Mercedes-Benz, and that's going to be by 2030.
Yes, with the what do you call it? The disclaimer that where market conditions allow, because anyone that's familiar with Australia's emission standards or lack thereof is that 2030 seems very early. But yes, there's been a string of these announcements from a lot of the European brands where they're committing to an electric only future by around 2030 or 2035, and Mercedes-Benz is the latest company to do so, and they've basically said that they're going to invest some 40 billion euros between now and 2030 on EV technology and platforms, and all of their future platforms from 2025 are going to be specific for electric vehicles. So it's a pretty big move, and I guess it's them committing to an all-electric future, again, where market conditions allow. And there's going to be three main all-electric architectures that they're doing from 2025, and they all have pretty basic names. There's going to be MB.EA, which is all medium to large vehicles under the Mercedes-Benz passenger car banner. Then there's AMG EA for performance cars and Van EA for their vans. So they've basically, I guess they're just going to invest in three main architectures that will underpin all of their various model lines, and it'll I guess their range will shape around that. But that's not to say that their combustion engine cars or their hybrids will disappear as soon as the calendar flicks over to 2025. A lot of their current cars are fairly new, and you know, we've got a new S-Class that's just come out. We've got a new C-Class coming. We've got some of their other cars like the EQA and the EQC that are electric vehicles based on architectures that were originally meant for combustion engine vehicles. So we'll probably just see a mix of cars over the next decade or so, and you know, with ongoing updates and revisions as time goes on. But I guess all of their future products, or you know, all of their concepts from the over the next couple of years that lead into production cars, will be all based on this new electric vehicle stuff. So I guess the three-pointed star will be very zingy in about 10 years' time.
Very zingy. Billions of dollars in product development. Summed up in one word. Very zingy.
And that's why I don't work in their marketing department.
I love it. I'm not surprised by this next news, Will, that the 2022 Chevrolet Corvette is now sold out in Australia.
Yeah, so basically GM Specialty Vehicles confirmed that 228 vehicles were coming in the initial allocation. They all have names against them. So GMSV is, as everyone will know by now, obviously Holden has closed up shop, and HSV is no more. And GMSV is a company that brings in different vehicles, most of which are converted locally. So like your Silverados are imported from the US and then converted to right-hand drive locally. The C8 Corvette's a bit different because for the first time, Chevrolet has actually got a factory right-hand drive operation going on for the Corvette. So they'll be exporting it to markets like Japan and Australia, where we drive on this side of the road that unfortunately means we generally miss out on vehicles like this. So GMSV's got 57 dealerships, and each of them is going to be receiving 4 C8 Corvettes. And I believe each one of them is going to, one of those vehicles is going to be the Carbon Edition, which is like a special edition flagship model for the Australian market. Now, GMSV has said the first C8 Corvettes should arrive in Australia by the end of December 2021. So this is just the first allocation, but GMSV hasn't revealed details on when the following allocation will be, or how many allocations they expect to get through the year, et cetera, et cetera. The good news is, if you have put your name next to a C8 Corvette, you might still get it in time for Christmas. So this is obviously really exciting news for Corvette enthusiasts, because it's obviously a very, very interesting car. And we've also seen that the Z06 name has been trademarked in Australia by GMSV. Chevrolet has released a teaser for the Z06, which confirms the perhaps worst kept secret that it will have a flat plane crank V8 engine. So it's always very interesting with Corvettes. They release just the regular Corvette, and you're like, wow, that's pretty fast. I mean, when you think about it, 6.2-liter V8 engine, 364 kilowatts, 0 to 100 time in 2.9 seconds. Doesn't seem like there's really much room to improve from that. Mm. But as we always see with Corvette generations, there's just more and more and more powerful models that get rolled out during the run. So stay tuned for that. But yeah, fingers crossed, if you have ordered a C8 Corvette, you will hopefully get it before Christmas.
Yeah. I still can't believe the price of that. Like your story mentioned comparing it to a Porsche 911. Was it a GT3 that you said?
Yeah, it was a Turbo S.
Oh, Turbo S,
so,
yeah.
That's actually 0.2 seconds faster to 100 kilometers an hour, but it costs $473,900. And the C8 Corvette range, and all models will actually come with the Z51 performance package standard in Australia. So that's adaptive magnetic ride control, suspension, larger Brembo brakes, dual mode exhaust, electronic LSD, all that lovely stuff. And of course, 0 to 100 in 2.9 seconds. And the range will actually open at $144,990 before on road costs.
Crazy.
I feel like GMSV probably could have actually charged more, and people might have been willing to pay for it. But look, that's just phenomenal, especially considering they no longer convert to right-hand drive the Camaro locally. And with the local conversions, obviously that adds extra expense on there. But because this is a factory right-hand drive operation, a base C8 Corvette is still obviously more expensive than the old ZL1 Camaro, but it's not actually massively more expensive. So for this, for something that is pretty much Chevy's kind of Ferrari rival when you think about it, it is effectively a supercar, a mid-engine supercar.
And it looks it too. That's why I can't quite believe the price really reflects how it looks. So in a good way, yeah. And lastly, JWO, we have seen a global reveal set. We've got a date for the 2022 Subaru WRX.
Yes, a next generation one. And like in most Japanese brands, a lot of these things are so hotly anticipated because cars like this last for way too long. And then you're just waiting for the next one and then they make you wait a long time for the next one.
Yep.
So it will be revealed on August 19 at the New York International Auto Show, which I didn't even realize was a thing anymore because I thought motor shows were dead after COVID.
Yeah.
They were pretty much, they were dead before COVID. But yes, get ready for the reveal of the Rally Legends New Evolution, Subaru says in a short press release. They've released some interesting screen teasers from a little short video that they published online, and you can see a very bright orange colored thing whizzing past. You can see some exhaust tips and a taco revving, which is very creative. But we've seen
sorry, sarcasm.
That wasn't meant to be mean. But we sort of have a very rough idea of what it might look like, because in 2017 Subaru put out the Visiv performance concept, which I remember covering as a budding baby journalist. And it was, you know, at the time, this thing looked amazing. It's got like all the new Subaru design elements, but it's this really fat, chunky four-door sedan with like an Aston Martin 177 rear light signature and stacked tailpipes like a Lexus ISF, and a really stunning car. But I've learned to not get too excited for Subaru production cars because the concepts are always really sexy, and then the production models order. You know those memes where it's like when you ordered it versus when it arrives? So that's how I feel like.
Yes.
Mitsubishi and Subaru are such culprits of that meme in real life, because their concepts are so good looking, and then only some of it filters down into, like, elements of it filter down to the production car, but they just make the concepts look so, so good that it's so hard to make a production car that lives up to that same look. So I guess a lot of people, I feel like Alborz would be one of the more eager people to watch this reveal, funnily enough, because he always talks so highly of his old WRX STI. But so August 19 is the reveal. We're not sure exactly what's going to be powering it, but it's pretty likely that 2.4-litre turbocharged boxer engine from the Ascent SUV that they do in America will be powering it, because I find it odd. I don't think that they would develop a whole new engine for it. They'd probably just find a way to find existing stuff and calibrate it for the right model. I imagine it'll have a 6-speed manual and a CVT option, and obviously all-wheel drive will feature. They haven't really said anything about an STI version yet. I would think that they would have one coming at some point.
Surely.
But they've sort of gave us all the hints without giving us all the hints. They're very, very vague with all the teasers, but we sort of know what's coming. But so stay tuned for, you know, I think that's what, 3 weeks away. So
it is
not too long to wait. And I think a lot of people have been hanging out for this for a long time. So hopefully the actual production model lives up to the hype, because I was really excited for the LaVorg, because the LaVorg concept looked really, really good. And then they did the LaVorg concept, and that, like, they actually called it the LaVorg concept. I was like, yeah. And then they sent out the engine specs and the production model pictures, and I was like, did it to me again.
Yep.
Subaru should know by now that the reaction to their concepts is always really positive, and then people often feel a little bit let down. So why don't they just release concepts where it's just the production vehicle, and they just, I don't know, chuck some bigger wheels on or change the headlights, and then that way people know exactly what they're going to get with the production model instead of getting their hopes up.
Well, it seems like they're so focused on the US market that they can just put out something that looks like the concept and the Americans will buy it, because like 90% of their sales globally come from America, and they buy like all the CVT boring stuff. So let's just hope this is a car that will get us interested in that brand again, because like I've grown up with Subarus and Hondas, for example, and both of those brands are a shadow of their former selves. It makes me so sad. So I hope that this will be a rejuvenation for them.
You can add Mitsubishi to that list as well, unfortunately. They still, all three brands still make good cars, but they just don't really make that much that's that exciting. At least Subaru's got the BRZ still.
Yeah, well, and Honda still has a Civic Type R, and the next generation Civic looks all right. I'm still waiting for something exciting from Mitsubishi, but you know, we'll see how we go.
I hope you like SUVs.
True. All right, that's a wrap for this week's news. Head to carexpert.com.au, click the news link if you would like to read more. Hello to you, Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy.
You're going to give us a little bit of a tease because you're sitting in a car that you're going to be talking about next week, the Genesis G70. Seems yes. like it's a good podcast studio tonight.
It's my beautiful Napa leather quilted, perforated red, beautiful studio. Genesis has really gone to town on this interior. This is the twin turbo six, top of the range one with the options pack on it. So it's got the 3D digital instruments and the all sorts of cool stuff in it. Really having a good time in this car, actually. So looking forward to talking about it, but I'll keep my powder dry until next week.
Yes, absolutely. What you're going to talk about now is a latest piece that you've been writing about the rise of retro-inspired EVs. This really pricked my interest. Why do you think this has become a thing?
It's fascinating, isn't it? So, yeah, retro design comes in waves, doesn't it? I remember around the year 2000, every brand was doing retro, the Chrysler PT Cruiser, the Volkswagen Beetle, the Crossfire Chrysler, the original Mini Rebirth. Retro was back, and it's come full circle, and retro is again back now. But manufacturers are using it to, I guess, promote their electric vehicles. We've got cars like the Volkswagen ID Buzz, which is, of course, the combi for the 21st century, the Honda E, the Hyundai Ioniq 5, which is just straight out of the original Pony design. Renault has got a 4 and a 5 coming back, two incredibly iconic vehicles. There's the Fiat 500 EV, of course. The Opel Manta has been promised. I could go on and on and on. And I think it's a really interesting conversation point because, for me, you're promoting new technologies. Electric vehicles are still a bit scary to some people. And on the one hand, one way that you can really make that technology approachable and positive and, I guess, inject some emotion into what could potentially be a sterile vehicle for some people without the exhaust note is to put a lovable, friendly design on it that sort of harks back to an earlier time, a simpler time, moves you emotionally as well as technologically. And then on the other hand, you go, well, electric vehicles are supposed to be the most high-tech technological flagships of a brand, and is it a bit of a retrograde step to make them look like an old car? And I guess you could kind of fall on either side of the argument, and I'm going to prosecute both arguments and kind of leave the finding up to the reader, but I just think it's an incredibly interesting trend that we're seeing with manufacturers tarting up their EVs and making them look retro. What do you guys think?
No, it's really fascinating because with every retro futuristic design that comes out, it just makes you wonder, oh, what's next to be resurrected? You're almost excited to see, oh, you know, is Fiat going to do a 124 follow-up that's an EV? Like, you've just got no idea what's going to happen. I wonder how long it will last, just because, Mocha, you're absolutely right. That retro boom in the early 2000s, a lot of those models were just one generation wonders. You know, the Ford Thunderbird. I mean, the Beetle went on for another generation, which I find really interesting because Volkswagen is resurrecting the concept of a combi with the ID Buzz, but they're not doing an electric Beetle. But Aura is doing its Punk Cat, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is an EV. And then there was another Chinese company that I saw patent images for a five-door Beetle knockoff, presumably an EV as well. So I think Volkswagen's missing out on that market.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, it's kind of genius, right? Because if there's one shortcut to, I guess, making a vehicle get crossover appeal, pun kind of intended, but if there's one way to make a new technology appeal to people who don't give a crap about cars, it's wrapping them up in a design that everybody knows and understands and loves. And it's kind of a shortcut to generate interest. But Will, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said last time we went down this retro road, it really ended in tears, pretty much for all bar the Mini, which is still going strong, although some would argue that product has become something quite different to what it originally was. And I'm glad you mentioned the Ford Thunderbird because I completely forgot that even existed in reborn form. But, you know, for me, it's just another example of the way manufacturers are trying to make electric cars not only meet regulations, but also make them sexy, exciting, and cool. In a sort of Tesla went a very different way about it, but the legacy manufacturers, I guess the other side of it is they've also got something to tap into that the likes of Tesla or, you know, any number of these EV startups that we see popping up everywhere, left, right, and center. Legacy manufacturers with decades or even more than a century of experience and history to draw upon have this thing that Tesla can never do, which is hark to the past. And so perhaps there's also something along those lines that's driving this move. But it's just such a big trend. And I guess the other part of this question that I'm curious about is, what are some classic vehicles that you would like to see be reborn? And from my perspective, my all-time favorite car, bar none, is the Renault 5. That is my all-time favorite vehicle. And I know that's a ridiculous thing to say for a car journalist, because we're supposed to like supercars. But I got T-shirts with the Renault 5 on them. I adore that car. And Renault bringing back an electric one in a modern style is making me really excited. But what are some choices you've got, Mandy? I feel like a Beetle and a 356 maybe for you.
Totally. You know,
what do we want brought back?
I saw on my social media feed today a rendering of a Type 181 Volkswagen. So think of a Kubelwagen, one of those, you know, World War II cars, but a little bit more mainstream, and it looked sweet. Like, it had a higher riding height, off-road tires, SUV without a roof. Like, yeah, please.
what about you, Joey? Ronnie? Is there a classic car that you want brought back as an EV?
When I think of old cars that I like, I don't really have the love for, like, classic normal cars the same way as I do, like modern classic supercars from like the 90s, because, you know, I'm a bit younger than you guys. I didn't have all the cool 70s and 80s stuff. So
I'm barely older than you, but nothing.
You're much older than me. Anyway, so there's not anything that springs to mind for me, but I understand the appeal of the concept, because for me, like, I love the idea of having a plug-in hybrid or electric version of my Golf. And they did actually do that in Europe, but they never brought it here, because I don't feel the need to drive a science project just to tell everybody that I'm being eco-friendly. I like the idea of having a normal-looking car, and it might have, like, a blue strip on it, or, like, you know, a charging port on it, and it's like, oh, yeah, see, this is my little bit, but I don't like to be super out there. And I feel that resurrecting, for example, the McLaren F1 or Ferrari F50 as an EV is just redundant, because part of those cars is, you know, the roaring V12s or whatever engines they had back then. So I you know, maybe the Beetle's a good idea. I'm surprised they haven't come back with that just yet, but I've had this sort of conversation in my head a few times as to why you look at Volkswagen, right, and they've brought out the ID range, and then there are some ID models that sort of look like classic cars, and there are some that just don't look like anything that they currently do. And I'm wondering whether they're going to gauge the consumer reaction to it and potentially slap historic nameplates on it. Like, maybe there'll be an ID Golf and an ID Passat once they get through this first generation of ID products, because people want to bring back those nameplates again, or whether
ID Carmen people will- Gear.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, or whether, yeah. Whether people love the ID stuff, or, you know, whatever the respective line of EV stuff is for any other brand, and sort of go with that new age design. But I just feel like in terms of cars and mobility over the last 50 or so years, most people that have grown up with cars over the last 50 years, it's still fairly new. So it's like you're completely overhauling everything again, not that far into it. So people have grown up with nameplates or brands or designs and stuff that they really relate to. And I just worry that if they don't sort of make the retro startup thing again a thing, or like a modern remake of whatever's fairly current or recent, I just don't know if that's going to be successful until all the old people that like old cars, or I don't know. I don't think I'm verbalizing it very well, but it's an interesting thing. And I like the idea of having retro stuff with new age input. Like, I like that with, like, fashion or.
When you say old people, Wongy, I presume you're referring to people born in the 1980s, like Mandy.
Collectively.
More like Croft's age, but then, you know.
He's maybe caveman, Croft, though.
Yeah, Croft's idea of a retro remake is more like an electronic Tyrannosaurus Rex, but, you know, we you know. Anyway.
I've been sitting here this whole time trying to think of an answer to your question, Moko, and
Volvo 240 wagon.
Oh, it's yes. One that really,
As a former Volvo 240 owner, and I owned a Volvo 240 for a couple of years, it was one, it's obviously, again, like the Renault 5, one of my all-time favorites. And I couldn't agree with you more. I think we know that an EV architecture, a skateboard platform, opens up tons of packaging possibilities because you don't have a prop shaft and a drive shaft and all these things running through the interior. The whole point of the 240 was practicality. And the whole point of the 240 was, you know, putting function ahead of form. Well, an EV only opens the doors to that even more. And of course, there's the Citroen DS. There's all these old classic vehicles that could be reborn. And I'm not talking about upcycling. I'm talking about new cars with designs that pay homage to the old with the new. But I agree, the Volvo 240 could be a classic. But look, this story is being worked on, and I'm hoping it can be a little bit of a conversation starter for everybody.
Like it has with us now. We could be
already
talking
working.
About all these cars. Yeah, we could talk about this all night. I'm looking forward to this piece, Moko. And look, we'll talk to you next week again about the Genesis G70. Enjoy your drive home.
Can't wait, guys.
The Toyota CHR Hybrid has been around for a good while now, but it has to make room now for the new kid on the block, the Kia Niro Hybrid. So, Joe, you thought it was a good idea to put these two back to back. How exactly alike are they?
Yeah, it was an interesting one because it didn't immediately occur to me when I booked them, because we had the CHR in for actually another comparison that Mike Costello is currently riding. So I had the two cars in and I was like, oh, they're actually not that similar, not that far away in price. They're both hybrids. They're both in the small SUV segment. It kind of just makes sense to compare them. So, yeah, in terms of how different they are, they technically compete in the same segment, which is the small SUV segment, according to VFACTS. The Niro that we had is the top of the range one, which is a little bit on the expensive side. So it's 46 grand drive away, but the CHR is maybe three or so grand cheaper than that at recommended retail pricing. So there's a little bit of a price gap there, and they're sort of different in form as well. The CHR is very design-led. It's got like a coupe-ish sort of form, and the Niro is a bit more of your jacked-up hatchback-looking thing, and it's quite boxy and not super adventurous in terms of the design. So it's two very different takes on a very similar formula, because they're both petrol-electric hybrids running low-powered petrol engines and then a hybrid system with a battery and a motor. So the fundamentals are all pretty similar under the skin. It's more of the execution that's quite different.
How do you think the reaction has been to the introduction of the Niro in terms of sales as well?
Well, it's only been on sale for a few months, I think Kia was pretty open at the beginning, because the Niro's been out in other markets since like 2015, 2016. This is like when I first started as an automotive journalist all those years ago. As you'll remember, Mandy, we started in the same week, remember?
We did, yeah.
But yeah, the Niro was new back then, and that was that they launched with the hybrid one first. So the drivetrain and the actual shape of the car has been around for quite a long time, and I think that a lot of people are aware of that, because I think with the way that Toyota's really pushed hard with its hybrid stuff, a lot of people have been sort of looking for alternatives, because not everyone wants to buy a RAV4, even though the sales charts might suggest otherwise. And so they've known that there are other products out there like the Niro, but it's just never been available. So I think at the moment they're doing about 100 units a month, but that's across all three versions. So they offer a conventional hybrid, which is the one that we had. They also have a plug-in hybrid, and then they have a full electric one, which is probably the one that Mike Costello would have talked about when they launched it, because that was the main car for the launch. So that's across all of those. I don't know the full breakdown of each variant and what they're selling at, but yeah. I haven't seen any on the road myself. I wasn't – most press cars that I get into these days, I get in and I start noticing them everywhere. You'll be like, oh, friend, and like, oh, someone else bought one. But with the Niro, I was very much the only person driving the Niro. But that's not necessarily a bad thing.
That's true. There's one around my neighbourhood, actually, but it's white and it's got the plain wheels. And my next question was, what do you think of the design between the two? I think the CHR is very bold and in your face, very sharp design, but I find the Niro a little bit bland.
Yeah, it definitely is a lot more conservative. And if you get anything other than the variant that we got, you get those really small, like, rental spec 16-inch alloys that don't look particularly exciting. The hybrid sport, which is the one that we had, gets 18-inch wheels, which are quite a bit larger, and it also gets Michelin Pilot Sport tires, which is so random. It's so random. I don't understand why. Maybe they were like, let's put the sport in sport, but we won't do anything to the drivetrain. I don't know. But it in this spec, it looked all right with the bigger wheels, and it had a really nice pearl white paint job. I like the front of it a lot. I think the front's very elegant. It's got that sort of last generation of Kia design that was quite organic, shapely. The lights sort of the lights are nice, and the grill, the Tiger Nose grill, sort of all, it all fits in very well. Whereas some of their later design, their current designs are a bit more angular and a bit more out there. Just look at the new Sportage, for example. It looks like an alien in a space helmet. But yeah, I think the back isn't quite as nice. I don't like a lot of cars that have very like almost like bullet shaped fronts that are quite round and almost like streamlined looking. And then you get to the back and it's like completely chopped off at the end. Mm. But you know, it's definitely more conservative. I like it from certain angles, and I think it looks good. But as you said, the CHR is obviously a lot more interesting, and then you've got the cool lights and signatures on the CHR that will probably find favor with more people because they're everywhere. Contrast there, like when I was in the CHR, everyone had the same car as me, even right down to the color combination. The silver with the black roof is a really nice spec. I think it was what they actually launched the car with back in like 2017 or 2018 with the original version. It's quite a popular color scheme that they have on them, but that you can get so many colors for them as well. There's like bright yellows and aqua and white roofs, black roofs. Yeah. So there's definitely a contrast there.
Yeah.
Why do you think the CHR, I mean, the CHR sells well, but most Toyotas tend to be like one of the three best-selling vehicles in their segment, and the CHR seems to be a little bit further behind a lot of others in the small SUV pack. What do you think Toyota could have done differently to make it a better, stronger seller?
Supply. They've had supply issues since the day they launched it. Mm. Because it's I think they only make them... I don't know if they make the European model in Europe. I think at the very beginning, they were making them mostly in Japan for everywhere. And so there's like only a handful of facilities that make them, and they're popular everywhere. So I think they're popular in Japan, they're popular in Europe, and they're popular here. So I think they just can't get enough. And especially given the current climate with semiconductor shortages, COVID manufacturing delays, shipping delays, all that kind of stuff, I think the numbers are more down to them trying to get as many as they can rather than them not actually selling them, because they're, you see them everywhere. So they consistently sell anywhere between 700 to 1,000 a month. And so I think they're just selling everything they can get their hands on. They just can't get any more.
Let's talk about how they drive, shall we?
Yes.
Which one did you think was the most comfortable?
In terms of comfort, I think the CHR really has that down pat. Being based on the same platform as pretty much everything that they do at the moment, all of their front drive cars are based on a version of the same architecture. And the way that they've found a balance between overall comfort and then just dialing in a little bit of driver engagement so that it's still fun to steer, and like it just feels like it's an extension of you. The controls are all very predictable. They're all very accurate. They're all very progressive, very fluid. And it just makes it super easy to thread through traffic and, you know, go through city streets. Like commuting to work in the CHR was a joy because it just did everything you wanted it to. The seats are comfortable. There's a bit of suppleness to the ride to get rid of all those bumps. And the way that the CHRs, this is the main difference between these two in terms of the drivetrains, is that the CHR does the typical Toyota thing where it's got an eCVT. So it's, instead of having gears or whatever like you might be used to in some other cars, it just sort of like, you know, does a progressive flare of the revs and sort of drops off as you come off throttle. Whereas the Kia has a dual clutch transmission, and the electric motor is sort of built into that, or it runs between that. The technical terms I'm lost on them a little bit, but that's the main difference. So when you actually drive the Kia, you know, in hybrids you have like the power meter that shows you going from like eco to normal to power. So they both have similar instruments, but with the Kia you're putting it into like normal or power, and you can hear the drivetrain going and like doing like proper gears, or sometimes between first and second you'll feel that gap in torque, whereas the CHR, it's a much more linear and progressive thing. So yeah, the CHR, if you drive it sedately, is very smooth, it's very refined, it's very comfortable, it's great. The Kia is a little bit more on the firmer side, so the ride's a little bit firmer. It's obviously got bigger wheels. They both aren't the most quiet cars on the move. Like on course chip roads, they're both a little bit noisy, which was a bit disappointing, but I guess they're both city focused. But while the CHR was quite like, it feels quite nimble and light and you can sort of play with it a little bit, it doesn't feel super sharp or keen. It sort of just does it without it being super engaging. Whereas the Kia feels like quite tight and taut and like, you know, you can really, there's a bit of weight to the steering. The chassis itself feels a little bit wider and lower. So it feels a little bit more hunkered down. So it's more in terms of like which one is better, it's more about what you prefer. If you like that little bit of refinement or insulation dialed in where you enjoy feeling like, you know, like you have a very direct connection to the wheels and all that kind of stuff, but you like that supple ride and a little bit more insulation from the world around you, the CHR is probably the more comfortable everyday driver, whereas the Kia is a little bit sportier. And the drivetrain in the Kia felt a little bit more responsive. It's got a little bit more power. With the proper transmission, it feels more like a normal car. So if you don't like how CVTs sort of rev, or the lack of torque in the CHR's petrol engine means that once you get off the electric motors, it can sort of, you feel that sort of shunt because you're expecting a little bit more response and it doesn't really give you that. Whereas the Kia, it's a little bit more, it's better in that regard. It feels a bit more progressive and it feels a little bit more engaged and more put together in that respect. So it's more about what you prefer in terms of how it drives or whether you actually care about that in the first place. But in terms of fuel efficiency, which is obviously one of the main reasons you'd buy a hybrid, they were pretty much line ball. They were both doing about 4.8 to 5 litres per 100 Ks in mixed driving, and it was pretty hard to get any more than that. So they're both quite efficient, and I didn't necessarily drive any different to how I would normally drive. I was, you know, in traffic and you're keeping up with traffic, you're braking, you're accelerating, people are cutting you off, all that kind of nonsense. So yeah, they were both pretty similar from a fuel economy respect. What I sort of noted in the results was that the CHR is the better all-round package, and I think that would be, out of those two, would be the one that I recommend to most people because it's cheaper to buy. It's not that much smaller in terms of rear seat space, even though you've got that sweeping roof window line at the rear. So if you carry passengers a lot, it might be a little bit claustrophobic back there and the boot's smaller. But in terms of how it drives, it has more features. It feels a little bit more luxurious and a little bit more special. It'll probably appeal to more people. The Kia is better if you like how feeling a bit more engaged and a bit more connected. And it's obviously a bigger car. But both of them are so close in price to a RAV4 hybrid. And whether you get a base or a mid-spec, there's not that much in it. Like a top spec, say CHR hybrid, is not that different to a base RAV4 hybrid than the Niro's closer to like a mid-spec. And I just feel like more people would feel like they're getting more for their money if they got the RAV4. So you can see why that car's like got 6 to 8 month waiting lists, because it sort of meets the smaller ones at that price point and gives you more, and then it also gives you the fuel economy that's not that far off either. So it's sort of a tough one because the Niro, I think one of my main issues with the Niro is that it misses out on a lot of features you can get in Korea. So in the Korean market, they deck it out with everything. You can get like ventilated seats and electric adjustment, memory, premium sound system, like a bigger like half digital instrument cluster that looks quite fancy, but they don't offer any of that here. I even had to turn the key myself.
What? Yes. How dare
like
they?
A sucker.
It was such an inconvenience because I also forgot that it was not keyless a few times, and I'm like sitting there trying to push a button on the dash, and I was like, oh, I have to actually put the key in myself. So both of them are good cars in their own respect, but they're both also quite fundamentally flawed. The CHR feels quite underpowered, and then at the price point, it's a little bit noisy on the open road. So you might be persuaded to go up to something like a RAV4 that's a bit more refined on the freeway if you do like longer stints on the road, and it's obviously a lot more powerful. Whereas the Niro is a little bit more fun and sporty, but then it's quite expensive to buy. It's an old design and it's missing a lot of features that you would expect of a car that size at that price point. So it was a very tight comparison, and sort of there's no clear cut victor in that that matchup, because it's more about, and I feel like this is a lot of the comparisons that I've done, because a lot of cars are just good these days. You can't really get a bad car. Yeah. So with this one, it was more like, you have to tell me what you want or what you need out of the car, and then I'll tell you which one is better for you rather than this one's better, don't buy the other one. So
yeah,
it's a tough one.
I just before we go, I noticed in the car expert ratings a massive difference between the cost of ownership. Can you take us through that?
Yeah, well, Toyota's managed to do this thing where, like, it charges you next to nothing for servicing. So the CHR is like $200 a pop for 5 years. So, you know, $1,000 for servicing over 5 years is like the cheapest that you're going to get, unless you're buying something that gives you free servicing. And in the mainstream segments, you don't really get that often. You'd have to go to like Genesis or get a Ferrari or something like that, because for some reason they give you free servicing. But then the Kia, it's like you have to, it was 2.5 times the price to service. It was like,
wow,
$2,500 over 5 years. And I was like, what the hell? Like, how the car's already more expensive to buy, plus you're doubling or double and a halving the maintenance costs. It just, that was why there was such a big discrepancy there. I don't understand how it can be that much more to service. So it's definitely cool, something to think about, because a lot of people, I feel, who buy cars, regardless of whether they're mainstream or premium, they buy the car because they like the look of it and they like how it drives, and they don't think about the running costs, and then they'll get shocked with a bill. Even though with most cars now you can actually look up the servicing fees, it's important now that most brands are pretty transparent with their maintenance costs, to actually do a little bit of research and see how much it's going to cost you to service. And the intervals are the same. They're both 12-month, 15,000 Ks, which is good. Toyota used to have 6-month, 10,000 kilometer intervals once upon a time, which is just ridiculous, and it probably would have closed the gap, because if you're paying twice, if you're going to the service center twice as much, it would have brought it closer. But yeah, so that was the main reason why I was pretty harsh on the scoring there.
Yeah, well, the CHR just narrowly won that comparison. You can head to carexpert.com.au under the comparisons tab to read that full comparison in length. That brings an end to this week's podcast. Still, as New South Wales is in lockdown, there's not really a lot of launches happening, so we'll get straight into the cars that we've got coming up next week, JWO.
Yes. So in the absence of exciting launches, we actually do have a launch car coming. So Scott Colley is going to be driving the Land Rover Defender 90, the three-door one. That got delayed by a couple of weeks because of our lockdown, but now we've got it in Melbourne next week. We've also got the updated Renault Megane RS Trophy. We've got a pair of Porsche 911 Turbos, one coupe, ooh, one cabriolet. We've got some exciting content coming soon. I won't spill all the beans today. We've also got a Land Cruiser Prado and a Volkswagen Tiguan in Melbourne, and that's pretty much it for Melbourne for now. Then in Sydney, we've got a Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross Exceed. I'm currently driving the LS. Yeah, I just gave it back. And
it's out of your mind now.
I just gave it back to them, and review coming soon, but they can also keep it. In Brisbane, we've got an Isuzu D-Max and Hyundai Kona Electric and a Honda CR-V. So Will and Alborz will be in a few different high-riding things.
I have been waiting to drive a CR-V for so long, and for that matter, I actually need to get behind the wheel of an Eclipse Cross. So
yes.
I'm actually excited to drive the CR-V.
Yeah, it's quite funny. Interesting backstory. Will messaged me not long ago being like, oh, when are we getting a CR-V through Brisbane, because I really want to drive one. And I said, just check the calendar, because I've booked, Alborz and I have booked one for you to drive, and it's been there for 3 weeks. I'm surprised you haven't seen it. I've never heard anyone so excited to drive a CR-V in my life.
I've driven like pretty much almost everything in that segment. Actually, I've got a list of vehicles that I would love to get booked in, that's just one that's eluded me for a while. So yes, I am excited to drive a CR-V.
See, my first car was my mum's original Honda CR-V, and I just feel like none of them have ever really given me the same like feeling, because the original was so cool and it did everything. The design, the proportions and everything were just perfect. I feel it was like the right shape, the right proportions, and it was just funky. I just feel like the new ones, they're just too generic, and like, I don't know, they do well enough.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. All right. If if you would like to ever get in contact with us with any comments or questions, our email is podcast@carexpert.com.au and we would love to hear from you.
Or thank if you're you very- selling a- Oh, sorry. I didn't mean so, to talk
oh, yes, if I'm selling so- model cars.
No,
yes.
I was going to say, or if you're selling a Cadillac Seville.
Oh, yes. That too.
No, don't. Keep it away from me. I'll buy it. No.
Bang goes the savings for your house. William Stopford and James Wong, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.